All right, don't worry. Stop worrying. It's going to be a great show. I know you're like, it's Wednesday. Are they just going to mail it in? But no, we're going to do a great episode of Catholic Answers Live today. Second hour, we got Dr. Popchak coming in from More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak. First hour, Trent Horn, and we're going to do tips for defending the faith. If you have, if you are in need of any tips for defending the faith, 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. I am Cy Kellett, your host. And Trent, welcome.
Welcome, Cy.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not going to tease you today because it happened again.
What happened?
Another email from a person who does not like that I tease you.
Another one.
Another.
Score another one for Team Trent.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently, people do. They do not think it is. It is funny or engaging or in any way entertaining that I tease you.
Please know that I do not mind when Cy Kellett. I wouldn't even call it teasing. I would call it playful banter.
Well, not everybody sees it that way.
So in our routine, am I the straight man, basically? Is that how this is coming?
I don't know, because you usually come out with the little zinger one-liners that move us on to the next thing, but you don't direct them at me.
No, they're just...
See, I like, especially because I sometimes...
I send them off into the void.
There's Carlo. Hi, Carlo.
Mr. Carlo
comes by the studio.
That's right. He's up at the second hour, right?
No. Dr. Greg Popchak, second hour.
Oh, you've got a shirt and tie. He must be off to doing something really fun and fancy. Whoa. I haven't worn a tie. I have not worn a tie since the conference. Since the fancy dinner at the conference. I don't even wear a tie when I speak.
Oh, you don't?
No. I don't believe
it. And
you
haven't even been doing much speaking anyways. So,
at least not to people.
Oh, you talk to yourself. You can't get any speaking engagement. Say no. See, now is that teasing you? If I say that, if I joke, no. You, I don't want to joke with you.
You can joke
no,
with me.
No, I'm not
okay.
gonna do it.
No, come on.
Because another letter of complaint. Oh. Don't stop hurting Trent Horn's feelings. It's not funny. You're teaching my children the wrong values. So I'm just not gonna do it.
Did
anymore.
They say you were teaching children the wrong values?
Something like that. 888-318-7884. Our number. 888-318-7884.
Yeah.
It's tips for defending the faith today, and you could. Could not get a better person than Trent Horn for tips for defending the faith. He's been defending for the pro-life position, defending life in all its stages, in all its forms, in all of its conditions. And then he became a Catholic apologist, defending the faith, defending the church. And he's got, I don't know, he's almost every week he's got a new degree or a new book. So I don't know how many degrees he's got. I don't know how many books he's got, but he can defend the Catholic
faith. I know that I have 3 graduate level degrees. I think I have 9 books. It's eventually like children. I'm sure. I think any large family here could know by the time you get more than 10, you're like, how many do we have again? How many? Are you one of our kids or one of the other kids? When you go to the playground and you have 10 kids, you get to the point where you're like, wait, are you one of ours? No, hold on. Get out of here, you.
Well, it's funny because I was just talking with Tim Staples yesterday about how California, you can have 10 people gathered now. And I was like, that's like one person to come over to your house. You can have one person
over
because there's 9 of you.
I have a friend, Cy, who has, so they have 5 children. So they have a household of 7. And they've gone out to eat at restaurants in other states. And one of the rules is to prevent the pandemic and all that, is 6 to a table, and you can't combine tables.
Oh.
So it's like the rule to keep people from the pandemic apocalypse or whatever is you have maximum 6 at a table, and you're not allowed to combine tables. So she said, well, what do? We have 7. They said, you could have one of the kids sit on your lap because we can't bring over extra chairs. And I'm like,
how's that helping?
This is what happens when you try to get bureaucracy to manage everything instead of providing helpful guidance and trusting individuals, which is something that I advocate for in my book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? The answer is no. Here's why.
Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? Trent's latest book. He's also the author of. Look, see how I'm helping you out now.
You did.
He's
that
also
was great.
Also the author of Why We're Catholic: Answering Atheism, Persuasive Pro-Life, and a very fine book that I will never tease him about again. What the Saints Never Said.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Also, I'm the host of the Council of Trent podcast, and we have a new podcast that just came out yesterday. I would highly recommend people go and check it out. You can listen to it for free on iTunes podcast app or Google Play or at Catholic.com. The podcast is called The Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L. I did a podcast called Racism, Riots, and a Catholic Response.
Oh, okay.
So I did a very timely episode talking about issues related to racism, the death of George Floyd, protests, violent demonstrations, riots, looting, and what our Catholic response should be to that. And this really hit home for me, Cy, because over the weekend on Saturday, there was a protest that devolved into a violent riot in La Mesa, which is only just a mile. What happened?
Oh yeah, right.
Well, there were the grocery store that was looted, the banks that were burnt to the ground.
Yeah.
The Played Against sports store that was just eviscerated. That all happened about a mile away from my home, and I was sitting up late. My family went to bed, and I was just staying up wondering what's going on, looking at the live stream, and then making sure this didn't bleed into my neighborhood.
Wow.
And so that prompted me to want to put forward a podcast that balanced many of the emotions I and other people felt, both at what happened to the death of George Floyd, what's going on with these protests, and also interjecting it with clear factual analysis and always keeping everything at the gospel at the center of our response. So that podcast episode is called Racism, Riots, and a Catholic Response. And you can check it all out for free at the Council of Trent podcast.
Very good. I'm glad you did that. I don't think we can stop continually saying, look, racism is a sin. It's sinful to carry it in our hearts. And I think it actually, in times like these, people are more tempted to it than in more peaceful time. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But you just got to not, you have to fight. It's like any, if you have a temptation in that direction, you have to fight it. Just like if you have a temptation to sexual sin, or if you have a temptation to sin with money, or any, you have to fight that.
What
in your
I
heart.
Said when this was happening, I remember I put on social media, I said that the death of George Floyd and not the peaceful protests, but those who have devolved into straight up looting and violence against innocent people, and property. Both the killing of George Floyd and violent looting against people and property exemplify the same part of our fallen sinful nature, which is this. We will hurt others to get what we want if we think there will not be consequences.
Mm, right.
That is human nature. That is fallen human nature. Fallen human nature is clear that we are all one step away from that. And that's why a life of grace is so important. And we need... Ultimately, we need Jesus Christ to cure that fallen and sinful element. Do we need to fix structural sins in society, or you know, things like unjust laws that allow sin to continue? Of course. That's why I've always advocated for making abortion illegal, for example. And it was good when slavery was outlawed, when racist laws were repealed in 1964. But merely changing society will not change people's hearts. And the only thing that can change people's hearts is the love of Jesus Christ.
Praise God. And we do love him, and he does love us. And all is well. We will recover from this as well. But we got to fight that, the sins in our own hearts. We got to fight and fight and fight. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-31-TRUTH. It's Tips for Defending the Faith today. Colby is first, calling from Washington State. Hello, Colby.
Hello. So I have a question insofar as I get into a lot of discussions with my friends, and I know that the Catholic faith has the fullness of the truth, but sometimes even when I present arguments to people, they ultimately reject them. And a lot of times it feels like it's on kind of flimsy grounds, and it frustrates me. And so I guess I don't know when to just let things lie and how to cope with that, because I believe that there are souls at stake here. So how can I reconcile that?
Yeah, I think, Colby, in our conversations, this is true both online and offline in the real world. It is the real world. And I think our conversations about the faith should take place person to person as much as possible. If you had a video chat because of the pandemic, fine. But I find conversations on social media to be 99% of the time unproductive. So Colby, are you speaking more primarily about like in-person interactions?
Yeah, it's usually in person, and they're usually with good friends of mine as well.
Sure, and I think that the question is, it's a great one. People ask me a lot, how do I know when to let the conversation go? And I think what we always have to have in our mindset is that the conversation doesn't have to go or end. It just needs to pause. So you should ask yourself, when should I pause this conversation? Because you could always resume it at another time, and you should leave the door open for that person to want to resume it. Because ultimately, we're never going to convince somebody in a single conversation of anything of great importance. If you can convince someone of something in a single conversation, it's possible you could evangelize someone, and in one brief conversation, they turn their life around. But usually it's a process. To change someone's entire worldview takes many, many conversations. So we have to think of conversations as like one pearl on the necklace, and we're always adding pearls to the strand, and we want to loop it together. So we have to think to ourselves, not when am I going to end this, but when do I pause it? And the time to pause a conversation is when you can tell that the other person is exasperated or tired, or they're making cues like they don't want to be there anymore. And that's why I find it's helpful in conversations to ask questions more than making statements like, so what do you think of this? Or what would you say to that? But a lot of times, Colby, especially, it's not what they say. The guide to tell when to pause the conversation, I would say 80% of the time is going to be nonverbal. The person's going to be crossing their arms. They're going to be looking away a lot, checking their phone a lot. They're going to sit and, you know, look squirming or in an uncomfortable position, or they'll try to change the subject. It's going to be hard to keep that person engaged. So we have to, it's an art to learn to see, okay, when are they done right now and they just need a break? It might not even be that it's animosity. It's just psychically they're bearing a lot that they're thinking about and they need a break to process it. So we should just be gracious and say, hey, you know, hey, something to think about. But hey, if you ever want to talk about it again, love to chat with you about it. You know, just let me know. And I think if we look at it as a series of conversations we pause rather than one that we end, it is just easier to have those talks with people. So does that help?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you so much. And thanks for your ministry. It's very inspirational.
Well, thank you. And thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Colby. I find you inspirational too, Trent.
Well, thank you, Si. I
appreciate
it. This
is part of my habit of just saying positive things to you and about you. And I'm going to keep that up. I'm not going to change that habit, because that's how I feel about you.
All right.
888-318-7884 is our number. It's Tips for Defending the Faith with Trent Horn this hour. And if you would like tips on defending the faith, maybe you run into a particular snag, something that someone says that you don't know how to work through that. You have a particularly difficult person who you'd like to defend the faith to, a situation that's difficult. You just like something more general, like our caller there about how to make a good judgment about when to continue, when to take a break, and when to end a conversation. 888-318-7884. I want to ask you to consider again Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. So many new classes coming out, so much good stuff. Trent's got a new class. Evidence for Catholic Moral Teaching, What the Church Teaches on Right and Wrong. It's the second course, and it's doing quite well. Lots of folks taking that course, and you can get it for $30 off if you sign up right now at schoolofapologetics.com. What do you cover in that one, Trent?
Well, we cover a lot of things. We cover life issues like abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide. We also cover foundational moral issues, moral philosophy, moral theology, conscience, free will. So we have the foundational elements, and then we apply them to moral issues, like issues related to life, abortion, embryonic stem cell research, physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia. We also cover issues related to chastity, so contraception, homosexuality, transgender, divorce, pornography. Then we also cover other social issues, so even things like religious freedom, environmentalism, and even economics like socialism. All that and more in my course, Evidence for Catholic Moral Teaching, to give you the tips to have productive conversations with people on these. Because a lot of times people who disagree with the church, it's usually the moral issues they disagree with primarily. I find 9 times out of 10, if they have a grievance against the Catholic Church's teachings, it's usually a moral issue. So it's important for us to be able to defend those.
You can go to schoolofapologetics.com to sign up. Schoolofapologetics.com. It's one of the, I think, I'm really glad that you guys did the moral issues second and so early in the course, because these are actually the major obstacles for many people.
They are.
Is the moral teachings of the church. So schoolofapologetics.com.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Is prayer powerful? St. Alphonsus Liguori put it this way: he who prays will be saved. He who does not pray, well, you get the point. Prayer can bring us salvation. It's the means of putting us into communion with God, and God can do all things. The more our will lines up with the will of God, the more powerful our prayers, and the simpler they become ultimately, be it done to me, Lord, according to thy word. That's the prayer God will always answer.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Trent Horn in studio with us right now, and we're doing tips on defending the faith. So if you'd like some tips on defending your Christianity, your belief in God, your Catholic faith, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Let's go to Melissa in Orange County watching on YouTube. I was going to say YouTube Live, but it's just called YouTube. Sorry. Melissa, your question.
Hi, Trent.
Hi.
I'm a psychology student in college, and sometimes when the topic of religion comes up, I notice that people try to belittle it by saying that religion is kind of a bunch of nonsense that can be explained by psychology principles, such as like the confirmation bias and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What would you say to skeptics like that?
Well, what I would say is that, Melissa, these kinds of objections, that they're very vague. And because they're vague, they can form a kind of universal acid that eats away at everything. So sometimes when people criticize the Catholic faith, you should ask yourself, okay, would this argument refute something else besides Catholicism? And if it ends up refuting everything, then it actually refutes nothing because it's so vague. So if the argument is religion is false because human beings have confirmation bias, by which, and what that means is we're more likely to believe data that supports what we already believe and ignore evidence that disconfirms what we already believe. So confirmation bias just means you're more willing to click on a link on the internet that supports what you believe, and you're going to pass over the link that refutes what you believe. We accumulate data that supports what we already believe. So, and I'm sure your classmates may have other objections, but if it's rooted in this, I could make a parallel argument. I could say, well, atheism is a product of confirmation bias. Many atheists, I mean, I'll talk to atheists here all the time on radio, and I'll ask them, what is the strongest argument for the existence of God? And they'll say things like, there is no strongest argument, or they're all equally bad, right? And they can't even give me a coherent argument because they've passed over the strongest case. They've disconfirmed it for themselves. So, you know, even there, whether you're religious, atheist, human beings have these different psychological biases, but that doesn't mean that just because we have psychological biases that what we believe is false. We all have biases. The question is not whether we as humans have biases. We all have that. The question is, does the evidence support the conclusions that we hold? Because you can examine evidence for something and get past your bias to do that. And so I would just say to them, look, there might be these psychological tendencies we have, but that doesn't take away from the evidence. Because if it was just these biases, then that would undermine atheism. It would undermine other ethical beliefs, other political beliefs. We should look at the evidence, not the fact that there are universal biases among human beings. So that might be one way I would go at it. Is that a helpful response, or are there other things that they brought up you'd like me to address?
Well, it's kind of like along similar lines. Like, sure. If I explain like the miracles of prayer, they might say, "Oh, your supposed answer that you got from prayer was really just a coincidence," or like we said, confirmation bias. But obviously, psychology can't explain miracles.
Right, and what I would say here is this actually brings up a good point, Melissa. That some evidence we would put forward to skeptics is not going to be compelling, and we should avoid it. So, for example, you know, if I prayed, Lord, please help me to be able to pay my rent this month, and then I got a unexpected tax return from the government, like, hey, you accidentally overpaid, by $500. And it's like, oh, man, it'll pay my rent. See, this is evidence for God. A skeptic would rightly point out something like the law of large numbers, that in a country, for example, with 330 million people, there's going to be lots of people asking God for help with rent. And there's going to be lots of opportunities where unexpected windfalls will come. So among hundreds of millions of people, you'll have fortuitous coincidences are bound to happen. So your classmates are right to reject that kind of evidence. But that wouldn't work for things that are legitimate miracles, like hundreds of people in Fatima seeing the sun dancing in the sky and even having newspaper reports contemporaneous at that time describing puddles drying up and clothes drying up because of it. So it's not a mere optical phenomena. It wouldn't explain a group of dejected apostles coming to believe their rabbi had risen from the dead, even though their entire culture had conditioned them to believe an executed Messiah was a failed Messiah. It wouldn't explain why the disciples came to believe Jesus rose from the dead and found his tomb to be empty. So I think that these elements, these psychological explanations, they can refute weak evidence for the faith, but not strong evidence for the faith. Actually, Melissa, if you stay on the line, I'll send you a copy of my book, Answering Atheism, because I have a whole chapter in there, and I mention arguments against the existence of God that rely on psychology. And one of those arguments is that, look, we can because your friends may say this too in psychology, we can reproduce the feelings in your brain that you get in prayer that can be reproduced in a lab. So therefore, you're not really praying to anyone. But that's a bad argument because the feelings I get in my brain when I look here in the studio and I see Cy Kellett, that could be re-stimulated in my brain to give me a hallucination that's not real. But
wouldn't
it doesn't
that be nice though if when I wasn't there, you could get little visions of me? That would be really nice.
Well, yeah, because I do enjoy your company, Si. It is quite pleasant. Yeah. Even when you playfully rib me, that is okay, listeners.
Nope, I don't do that anymore.
It's quite all right.
Nope.
So so stay on the line. We'll send you that. But yeah, so is that helpful?
Yes, so much. Thank you.
All right, no problem.
Thank you, Melissa. Call again sometime. 888-318-7884 is the number. It's Tips for Defending the Faith this hour with our good friend and a mighty apologist, Trent Horn. Let's go to Gabriel in Massachusetts, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Gabriel, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Trent.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm a teenager and a high school student, and I'm at like a point in my life where a lot of my friends are starting to lose respect for their religion. A lot of them are brought up Catholic, but many have already stopped going to church, and I think a lot of them, like, as soon as their parents stop making them go to church, that they're going to stop going.
Right.
So I'm wondering, like, what could I do to try and help persuade my friends that religion is important and that it's important to go to church?
Yeah. Well, Gabriel, what I would say is to help your friends to see religion as important, I would really recommend being a beacon of hope and a model of the Christian faith to them, for them to be able to see that. In 1 Corinthians 11:1, St. Paul says, "Be imitators of me as I am of Christ." Now, I wish that I could say that to people on a regular basis, but I always feel like, oh man, I'm really slacking off in different areas. But just imagine that is the goal for us as Christians. And it's a hard goal, but it's one the saints have shown by cooperating with God's grace we can get to. That through a deep prayer life, through a life of receiving the sacraments, through a life of practicing virtue, we can imitate Christ to such an extent that we can tell people, like St. Paul did in 1 Corinthians 11:1, be imitators of me as I am of Christ. And so when we do that, people will naturally see the importance of religion, and they will start to see that our life is different. I remember, Gabriel, it's actually interesting, after my conversion in high school, so I became Catholic when I was a junior in high school, and after that I had two groups of friends, and I never let the two meet because I had a non-Catholic group that had a more eccentric, kind of dark sense of humor that I worried would scandalize my Catholic friends. And my Catholic friends, they would even complain, like, don't you keep all your friends separated, like when you go to a cafeteria and you have the plate of food and there's the different compartments you put it in. They always felt like the carrots placed in one compartment and my non-Catholic friends were the gelatin placed in the other. I kept them apart. And eventually they came together. But my point is, with my non-Catholic friends, I would be an example to them. I would share my faith with them, but I wasn't like preaching down their throats or anything, but they would say things to me like, they would say things to me like, Trent, we don't always agree with what you believe, but it's a good thing. They would say like, I appreciate, Trent, that you're always there for us. You keep people in our group from doing dumb things that might hurt other people. And so when people see that you, Gabriel, when people see virtues in you, like the fruits of the Spirit, love, peace, patience, gentleness, and kindness, And you then they see that in you, and then you graciously invite them to take part in things that you find joy in, like going to Mass. Or you can choose other activities that maybe your more lukewarm Catholic high school friends would be interested in, like going to a good seeing a good Catholic musician, or going to a youth night at a parish where they're doing something fun and people can just hang out. So I'd say be that example, and then invite them to Mass or confession. And if they're not willing to go to that, try to find some other kind of activity with other good Catholics there, like a youth group. That's just a fun thing to do, and they can see there's other Catholics that live out their faith that are cool, normal, healthy people. So I hope that's helpful for you, Gabriel, and feel free to call back at any time.
Thanks, Gabriel. Trent Horn is our guest. Tips for defending the faith this hour. Lots of folks on the line, but you can still, there's one line open, 888-318-7884. We'll do our very best to get you on when we come back with Trent Horn, Tips for Defending the Faith on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on, we'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Why is it wrong to help someone commit suicide? Don't people have a right to die with dignity rather than being a burden to others? Does the Church teach that the terminally ill must be kept alive by machines for as long as possible? In 20 Answers End of Life Issues, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you unravel the controversies and confusions surrounding euthanasia, assisted suicide, and the rights of patients in our uncertain healthcare future. 20 Answers End of Life Issues is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries, Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952. Visiting shop.catholic.com or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Keller, your host. Trent Horn, our guest this hour. And we're doing tips on defending the faith. So if you'd like a tip or some tips for defending your faith, 888-318-7884, the number. We go now to Noah in Orange County, watching on Catholic.com. Hi, Noah.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for everything you guys do. I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you.
First time calling here. I usually speak to Patrick Madrid, Revelant Radio, but I know that's where he came from you guys as well.
I know. We haven't seen Patrick in a long time. I don't know what's up with Patrick. You just reminded me. I don't know what he's up to. Well, I know he's up to a million things. That's what he's up to. That's what Patrick does. Patrick's a very, very busy person. But yeah, you're right. We haven't had him on for a while. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
My question is, what's the best way to explain these riots and stuff with the looting and everything when Jesus came to the temple and overturned tables, grabbed the cord, chasing people out? How can we separate?
So is your question, some people say,
how can we understand it?
Right. So are you saying that some people say that because Jesus tipped over the tables of the money changers and engaged in violence against them. It just says he made a whip of cords and drew them out. It doesn't say that he inflicted violence on their persons per se, but he may have. He certainly inflicted violence on their tables. He might have broken certain things in driving them out of the temple. Is the question that because Jesus flipped over the tables of the money changers and drove them out, that because Jesus did that, why can't people engage in riots and looting today if Jesus started a little riot in the temple 2,000 years ago? Is that kind of the nut of the objection?
Yeah, sort of, because I encountered on Facebook, a family member posted a picture of a painting of Jesus flipping a table.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's all, here's for my religious folks, you know, kind of expressing what's happening right now. She's kind of not, she doesn't read the Bible and stuff like that.
Right, but yeah, and I would say this is a bad argument, saying, here, Jesus destroyed property here, therefore, it's always okay to destroy property, including in the looting that is taking place during these protests related to the killing of George Floyd. That's a bad argument. That would be like saying, well, here's a police officer who killed George Floyd, and I know there hasn't been a trial yet, but let's just assume, for the sake of the argument, that that was an unlawful, unjustified killing. And for all intents and purposes, it appears to be an unjustified use of force that led to manslaughter and the unjustified death of another human being. It'd be like saying, well, look, here is a picture of a soldier killing someone in wartime, so therefore this police officer could kill someone. Just because killing is okay in some contexts doesn't mean it's okay in all contexts. Likewise, just because destroying property is okay in some contexts, it doesn't mean it's okay in all contexts. So I would say, well, what are the differences between Jesus driving out the money changers and the looting that is going on in these in the riots that have happened? These are, when looting occurs, we don't have a peaceful protest anymore. We have a riot. What's the difference? Number one, the reason that Jesus overturned the tables and drove out the money changers was because what they were doing was wrong. They should not have been turning a sacred place in the temple into a place of commercial activity. Notice that Jesus did not go outside of the temple and then continue to tear apart the many shops that were in Jerusalem. He didn't do that. He just said, it's wrong for you to be doing this here in my Father's house. So if anything, Jesus was defending his own property against people who were unlawfully there. So when people bring up that example of Jesus turning over the tables, it doesn't correspond with the looters. It would correspond more with property owners using force to repel those who are unlawfully there. So actually, the argument of Jesus flipping over the tables does not support the looters. It supports the right of shop owners to use proportionate force to defend their property from people who are unlawfully there and are violating that space. So Jesus was defending his Father's house and the space that was being violated. He didn't go out and just, in a righteous anger, attack innocent businesses in Jerusalem or traders or merchants that had nothing to do with what was going on. Also, another point, Jesus didn't take the money from the money changers and keep it and then run off and do whatever he darn well pleased with it. The looters are taking property and keeping it to enrich themselves. So I would say it really does annoy me when people will see this activity and try to condone all of this violence against innocent people by saying these are individuals who are just aggrieved about racial injustice. And that's not true. I've seen interviews with people, with looters who've been arrested, who said they barely heard about the killing of George Floyd and they just wanted to get free money. They wanted stuff. A lot of these people, I think, are criminals. They're people who normally would operate as criminals in the dark secretly and have now had a chance to come to the light. I mean, everyone condemns what's going on with the looting. It amazes me there are some people who still won't condemn this. It's condemned by the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement. It's condemned by George Floyd's family. It's been condemned by political figures who are sympathetic to this. Everyone realizes you ought to peacefully protest against police brutality and against racism. That is obvious. But that nothing justifies looting and destroying the livelihoods of stores, many of which in these instances are stores that are owned by persons of color who are already members of marginalized communities. So it really does confound me a bit. But is that a helpful reply, Noah?
That's very helpful. I pretty much answered that.
already towards her post. But at the end, she just said, well, my point is that he was angry.
Right. And you could say to him, you could say to her, does being angry mean it's always okay to hurt other people? No, of course not. Being angry, you could say, yeah, it's okay for Jesus to tell people, get out of my father's house with your sacrilegious practices. But and so it's okay to be angry. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, in his letter to the Ephesians, he says, be angry, but don't let the sun set on your anger. So it's okay to be angry, to have a righteous anger, but it's not okay to fall into the sin of anger and vengeance and go out and hurt innocent people. And that just can't be justified. And you could say to her, would it be, who were you speaking with about this? Did you say it was a relative?
Yes, correct.
Okay, you could ask her, would it be okay for someone, because they're angry about the killing of George Floyd, would it be okay for them to break into your house and take your stuff and hurt or kill you? Obviously, if it would be wrong, if you would be outraged at them doing that to you, you should be outraged at them doing that to other people. So I would just recommend saying that to them. And also, I recommend my new podcast episode that just came out. Just go to trenthornpodcast.com, though you can listen to it for free at iTunes, Google Play. Just search for the Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L. And just go to the most recent episode that's come out. It's called Racism, Riots, and a Catholic Response. You can get it at Council of Trent on iTunes app, or it's available at Catholic.com as well.
Thanks, Noah. 888-318-7884, our number, 888-31-TRUTH. Up next, from Wichita, Kansas, is Nash. Nash, are you there with us?
Yes, I'm right here.
Hello, Nash. How old are you?
I am 8 years old.
Well, you speak very well, Nash. What is your question for Mr. Horn?
It was, where does the soul live in your body?
That's a good question, Nash. The soul does not live in a certain space because the soul is not made of matter. The soul is not like a little ghostly substance. It's not made of matter, so there's not a space in our body where our soul lives. But rather, our soul is present throughout our whole body. The soul is just the principle of life. The soul is what makes the cells of our body that are living and work together to keep us alive. The soul is what makes us a living body rather than a dead body. So the soul is what animates our whole body. It's present in our whole being. In fact, it's present in every living thing. That makes it a living thing rather than a dead thing. And so it's present in our body, though if our bodies are damaged so that our life can no longer be sustained, then the soul leaves the body. So it's present in the whole body while our bodies are alive. But then upon death, the soul leaves the body, and where we wait with joyful hope to be reunited with our bodies, our glorious resurrected bodies, at the resurrection of the dead. So is that helpful?
Yes.
All right.
It's very helpful.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for calling in.
Wow. You're really good at this. Like, I have to say, Nash, you're a better caller. I'm not saying this to insult our adult callers, but you're better than all of them. You're better than 100% of our adult callers. So you did a really good job.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Is there any chance that maybe you could get like a popsicle or some pudding for a reward? Is there anyone there that could do that for you?
Mom says yes.
Nice going, Mom. All right, we'll take a break. Enjoy your popsicle or your pudding, Nash. We'll be right back with more Trent Horn tips for defending the faith.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I want to talk to you about the importance of bringing the news to you every day. And we do that two ways on Catholic Connection. Firstly, we give you a newscast that I write and give to you to keep you up to date on what's happening in the world in the church. And then we also do interviews daily to help you understand everything from a truly Catholic perspective.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, tomorrow morning, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Trent Horn is our guest. If you're good and you do a good call, you can have a popsicle or some pudding. 888-318-7884. Up next is Dan in Kirksville, Missouri, listening on Covenant Radio there in Missouri. Hang on, Dan. Let me push the right button here. All right, Dan, go ahead. Your question for Trent.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
I have a suggestion. First, a reading. I'm reading Will to Love, Reflections for Daily Living by St. Maximilian Kolbe, Prophet of the Civilization of Love. It's very helpful. I encourage you to read that. My question is on racism and the abortion business. Why aren't these two topics ever brought together? I have some information on Minnesota from Paul at MCCL. The Black American population in Minnesota is 8%. They have 26% of the abortions.
Right.
This is figures from 2018.
Mm-hmm.
2,625 babies were killed. That looks out to be about seven babies a day.
Right.
Burned to death, poisoned to death, or cut up into pieces.
Right, right.
Why aren't these topics brought together as when we discuss racism?
Well, actually, I'm familiar with a fair number of pro-life advocates who talk about abortion as a kind of like black genocide. I think Georgia Right to Life actually had a whole page on that. I've known a lot of pro-life advocates who have noted the disparities, saying that African Americans make up a disproportionate number of women who choose abortion, far greater than the number of African-Americans that represent the population as a whole. So there may be, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if there are racist elements there among those who provide abortions. That wouldn't surprise me. Margaret Sanger, who helped to spearhead what would later become Planned Parenthood, was a notorious eugenicist. She started a paper that the Birth Control Review, whose goal was to create a master race of thoroughbreds. So she practiced eugenics. So there's a lot that was tied up in that movement. Though another way to explain it might just be that there are women who are poor often choose abortion, and there are lots of women who live below the poverty line or live under a certain income threshold. And there's just a higher proportion of women under that income threshold who are African-American, for example, that there are more African-Americans who are in poverty than maybe other races. And if people who are in poverty in large numbers choose abortion, then the overrepresentation there may not be due. It could be due to racism from policies that drive people into poverty, at least indirectly. So it may just be the fact that African-Americans make up a greater share of women who are likely to choose abortion. Though it wouldn't surprise me, however, if there are individuals within the pro-abortion movement who harbor racist feelings and strategically advertise and place abortion facilities to reach this particular demographic. So for more on that, I would definitely recommend check out some pro-life groups that have information on that. It's well worth to look into, that's for sure.
Again, it's Tips for Defending the Faith. Dan, thanks very much for the call. We go now to Ryan in New Braunfels, Texas, watching on YouTube Live. Ryan, your question for Trent Horn.
Hey, guys, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Not as well as we could hear that kid that called earlier, but we can hear you really well.
Well, I can't compete with her. I mean, she's very articulate. quick question for you guys regarding church authority. My wife and I are in our CIA and in the process of joining the church.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had some questions from Protestant friends and family, specifically regarding church authority, that
right.
If you have a church of human, fallible individuals, how could a church effectively protect that deposit of faith and you know, administer sacraments and forgive sins? Would a priest, for example, be able to on their own just decline to forgive sin or you know, same for a bishop or pope. So, again, that's kind of the line of reasoning they're using, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on a good counter there.
Okay, yeah. So I guess, Ryan, and this is similar to Melissa, another caller I brought up earlier, when people make objections to the Catholic faith, you should ask, does this argument kind of boomerang back at them or create a universal acid that refutes everything in its path? So if it refutes everything, then it's probably just an overbroad objection, or it's one that's not completely valid. So the claim here seems to be that if the Catholic Church is composed of human elements, human beings lead it, and human beings are fallible, so they could fail, does that mean that the church could then fail in its mission to save souls or to protect the deposit of faith? Well, by that logic, I would say that that could also apply then to the Bible. The Bible was, this is actually the same argument that atheists use against the Bible, that atheists will say, look, human beings are fallible. They could have made a mistake when they were writing the Bible. They could have made a mistake when they are copying the Bible, when they are compiling the Bible. So if that's the case, how can we trust the Bible when human beings wrote it, copied it, and compiled it? Now, your Protestant friends would probably tell them, well, yes, humans did that, but they're guided by the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit protected them from introducing any errors into the text, and God providentially protected the Bible so it would be passed along to us today. So if they will allow that defense for the Bible, then I would allow that. Then you should say, why can't that same defense be applied to the church so that the church is protected? And you should also make clear what the church is and is not protected against. It's not protected against leaders of the church committing sins, even grave sins. I mean, you could have a priest who denies someone the sacrament of confession without a good reason, and he would commit a sin by doing that. But God will not hold it against that person who's been denied the sacrament. And the church has a principle in church law that I forget the Latin phrase, but in English, it's the church supplies. The church supplies graces when there's deficiencies in its ministers. So God will not hold it against someone if they sought out the sacrament of reconciliation and a priest unjustifiably kept it from them. Though what's interesting here is that a priest does have the right, the duty even, to withhold the sacrament of confession in some instances, such as, for example, if a person is not repentant. If they're just going through the motions and they even just say that to the priest may say, well, you're not repentant, so I'm not giving you the sacrament. And there is a biblical warrant for this in John 20:23. In John 20:23, Jesus tells the apostles, whose sins you forgive are forgiven, and whose sins you retain are retained. Isn't that interesting? So Jesus told the apostles they could retain sins, which means they had a good reason for doing that. So what I would say is that within the church, its ministers could commit grave sins. We're not protected against that. What we're protected against is the church formally binding the faithful through an act of the church as a whole or through the Pope, through a special ex cathedra declaration. The church is protected from binding the faithful to an error in faith or morals, to an error in theology and faith or morals, to heresy. So I would say that you could run at that. You should clarify what is protected against, that there will be deficient ministers, but there is no deficiency in the deposit of faith that's handed on and in the church's teachings. And then that if this argument does not refute the human elements in Protestantism, such as in the formation of the Bible, it does not refute the human elements in Catholicism, and that Catholicism goes further and better explains elements of Protestantism, such as how we can know the books of the Bible were compiled together in a correct way, that we actually have the church gave them to us, and we know that historically through the revelation of Christ, through the testimony of the early church fathers, and through that. So I would recommend that. Ryan, I'll happily send you a copy of my book, The Case for Catholicism, that goes into this deeper. But is that helpful so far?
No, absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned the canon. I was actually listening to a Reformed Protestant professor, Michael Kruger, who actually made the argument that we can know the true canon through it being self-authenticating by, you know, but the language of Scripture being majestic and beautiful and all of this. And it's funny, your response is, you know, spot on. I don't know how they can say that the church couldn't fulfill its mission through the Spirit, but then also claim that through the Spirit we can know the canon.
Yeah, and actually, Ryan, so stay on the line. Give us your email address, because in Chapter 4 of my book, The Case for Catholicism, I address Michael Kruger's arguments for the Protestant canon based on the self-authenticating criteria. One of the things I point out is that if a book is able to authenticate the Word of God because of its majesty and eloquence, then that means that the Book of Numbers is out and Shakespeare is in. You know, I mean, there's plenty of non-biblical works that are majestic and eloquent, and there's plenty of passages in the Bible that are not majestic and eloquent, but they're still the Word of God. So whenever Protestants try to come up with a criteria for the canon on its own that gives us and only gives us their 66 books, we know there's actually 73, 72, depending on how you count, it just doesn't work. And so I cover that in, I believe, chapter 4 of my book, The Case for Catholicism. Give us your email address, and I will happily get a copy to you. I'm sure you'll enjoy checking that out. So thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. Going to keep moving because we're getting close to the end of our time with Trent. It's Tips for Defending the Faith. Second hour, Dr. Greg Popchak is going to be here, and it's a time of great anxiety. Dr. Popchak is a real pro, both on the theology of the Catholic Church and on the modern science of psychology. And if you'd like to talk about your anxiety, depression, or how to deal with those things in a Catholic, in a Christian way, in a compelling way with those who may be suffering around you, we'll be here the entire second hour to do that. Let's go to Al in Walton Beach, Florida, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Hi, Al. Got a question for Trent?
Hey, Mr. Horn. How are you?
I'm doing well, Al. Thank you for calling.
Hey, as an avid reader, I love your books. I got a quote from C.S. Lewis where he said, "Ever since I served as an infantryman in the First World War, I have a great dislike for people who themselves, in ease and safety, issue exhortations to men in the front line." Mm-hmm. Well, last week I heard a well-known Catholic apologist talk about how the atom bombs of World War II were sinful because, you know, the mask. He was very historically inaccurate. And as a five-time combat veteran,
right,
how do I address people like this who really don't understand combat and never been there? And when they, I took it personal because I've been in a lot of combat. And
sure.
When you go to do things for your country and overall you're saving lives in the long run, especially your shipmates' lives,
right?
I took really great offense to that. And I found it an ignorant statement, and I don't want to be mean or ugly, but how do you address people in, you know, as they say, in love, to
right.
address something like
sure.
this? That
well, I think, Al, here's how I would address all of this. First, I would say it is important to affirm the valor of those who voluntarily choose to serve our country in the armed forces. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to do that. War is hell. Pope St. John Paul II said, "War, never again war. It is an ugly thing that we should never hope for, but always be prepared for." However, the Church teaches that when we fight wars, when we wage war and conflict, it should always be a just war. So it should always be something where it's a last resort. All peaceful options have been exhausted. There's a reasonable prospect of success. The means that we use to win the war don't create greater evils than that which we are fighting. And finally, we should be proportional in our response. So the problem is I agree with you in the sense that we should not trivialize the actions of veterans, those who fight in wars, and we should understand the complexities that are involved. But at the same time, the Church does teach that there are certain things in war that we cannot do. And one of those things is the indiscriminate killing of civilians. And I think that's, for me, I think that's a pretty bedrock principle. Like when it comes to the use of an atom bomb, I could see how using an atomic bomb would make sense. I mean, we don't really do it anymore because all hell would break loose if we did this. But, you know, if you use the atom bomb to, like, combat a naval fleet at sea and you were only targeting other members of the military. But it seems pretty clear to me that we should be really careful in saying, well, this military method is justified because it will save X number of lives in the future. Like, to me, I'm really concerned about that. That sounds like consequentialism. Because there are certain things I think you and I would agree you should never do in war, even if it'll save more lives down the line. So, for example, would you agree, like, you shouldn't, like, bomb an elementary school or a hospital if you think it'll end a war sooner? Because, you know, that would be wrong. Would you, like, agree with something like that? Well, I'm sorry, we're out of time. I always keep a hand on the clock here. Al, I do thank you for your service. I do appreciate that. If you stay on the line and give us your email address, I'll send you an article at Catholic.com that I think weighs the issue of the use of the atomic bomb in war in a balanced way. Stay on the line. Give us your email address. I'll send that to you. Thank you again for your service, and thank you all for listening.
Thanks, Al. I'm sorry we didn't have more time for that conversation, because that's could be a very, very productive one. So if you want to call back again, that'll be fine sometime. When we've got more time, we'll discuss it more. Trent Horn, author of Why We're Catholic, and most recently, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? Thanks for a really great hour.
Thanks for having me.
You're the greatest, Trent. You're the tip top.
You call me the Mighty Trent Horn. If they ever make a cartoon about me, I want it to be called Trent Horn, the Mighty Apologist.
Okay. All right. Let's make a cartoon about him. Dr. Popcheck coming in next.